Welcome to another exciting episode of NID's Knowledge, this one being Real Space Strategy Edition. This podcast is produced by the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will inform you about the latest in space strategy and its importance to our national defense. Well, happy post-Independence Day, everybody. Thank you for joining us today. Today, I'm going to harken back to a previous episode where we talked a little bit about the white paper on competitive endurance, the proposed theory of success for the U.S. Space Force. And what I'm hoping to do is I'm going to talk to you about just a few issues that I found is kind of concerning. And the good news is as they state even in their own first page, that this is not something that is a fixed policy, but it's something to be discussed and debated. And so with that open invitation, I'm going to do that. One of the things that I've noticed in here and in a lot of the rhetorical speeches and posture statements and things in the last few months hearing season is the phrase space-enabled attack and a new definition of space superiority, which absolutely makes totally no sense whatsoever based on some very important bits of information that this strategy viewpoint misses. And so one of the things that they say in here is that space superiority is not just about protecting the joint forces' access to space capabilities, though that remains an important mission. Space superiority, if achieved, also protects the joint force from space-enabled attack. Now, space-enabled attack, what they're talking about is essentially viewing the Space Force as a space support force. So any missile system or airplane bomb or anything of that sort that an adversary or the U.S. or allies launch or drop is enabled by space systems such as position, navigation, and targeting like GPS, satellite communication for command and control, and weather satellites for forecasting over the target area, things of that sort. So it's very terrestrial focused. It mentions space in passing again. It's a matter of protecting it, they say. But the definition of space superiority, what used to be the able to, you know, take care of issues in space, instead, the definition they have is very odd. Let me get to that real quick. So they say space superiority is the doctrinal concept for domain control in space and is defined as the ability to conduct all domain operations at a given time and place without prohibitive interference from adversary space or counter space forces. And they also say that the objective, because the normal way of doing things would require overwhelming military force in any of the other domains, and as a result, they can't do that because that would be irresponsible and destabilizing to the space environment because it would create debris. And while I understand the idea of preventing debris, this whole document, and especially their view of space superiority, is very self-limiting and incorrect, and basically was written in a vacuum, no pun intended, away from understanding the adversary viewpoint of such things. And so I'm going to go through a little bit about the Chinese viewpoint, which any strategy or any white paper or any doctrine document that the Space Force creates that will lead to a new force posture or why they need to do their mission has to be based in part, and a large part in my view, on what the adversary is doing. They talk a lot in the document about the adversary being a competitor and about how they're building all these capabilities, where they say that they are hopefully not desperate and emboldened, to make sure that they're not desperate and emboldened. Well, those are two viewpoints that none of their writings and none of their behavior has ever indicated at all. So let's look at what they think. When reviewing the historical development of the Chinese viewpoint on space, one can see the importance of something called strategic culture. And strategic culture and strategic worldview can sometimes be synonymous, but essentially it helps you understand the intent and the why behind what they're doing. And they really have none of that in this document or any documents that I've found. What you can see when looking at the historical development of their viewpoint, you see the importance of sovereignty, self-defense, territorial integrity, and cultural superiority of strength of the Chinese government. And given the present international order is based upon Western American values, norms, and moral principles, and deterring the leadership of the People's Republic of China in space and on Earth really will require more than simply projecting universal so-called norms upon them, expecting them to simply agree to it, cease all development and deployment of their space weapons programs, or even prevent them from using it. Because I can guarantee you, from everything that I've seen in my own professional life, as well as in my military side, is that they're a very calculating and very strategic thinking country. They are not somebody who typically flips out of desperation and starts shooting things. So, to the Chinese strategist, to understand and appreciate one state of affairs in complex strategic planning requires the existence of what they view as the opposite. And what seems to be true now may not always be the case. It may be actually the opposite of what seems to be. And that's very philosophical. But basically, what that means is their view is applicable to that when the Chinese sign on international agreements such as the Outer Space Treaty, when their strategic behavior appears to trend toward another course. So they always have someone's going to be strong, someone has to be weak. And if someone is weak, the other side has to be strong. And the objective of the Chinese is to be the strong one and get the United States into the weak position. Because over hundreds of years, what they call the century of humiliation, and before that a little bit, they have been on the low end, while the Western powers have been on the high end, and they're trying to shift in a direction to flip that. And so, as John Boyd has stated, strategists must focus not on technology or capabilities assessments in a vacuum. They must recognize and follow the strategic behavior, which the documents mostly coming out of the Space Force are focused on not only technology, but on the ability of technology to support terrestrial operations and has nothing to do with space as a theater of operations, which is, by the way, very contrary to the Chinese viewpoints. So the Chinese leaders have repeatedly stated that the importance of China's role in building a harmonious world internationally is not talking about supporting the status quo, which the United States is all for and our allies are for, but to make sure that they become the keepers and propagators of harmony in the world. So while an American view of transparent, integrated political interaction with all nations may imply a view toward a gradual evolution toward a more globalized world that shares Western values of liberty, free trade, and freedom of access to the global commons, or sometimes called the shared spaces of ocean, air, and space, the Chinese hold fast to their unique civilization as superior and returning as a nation at the center of the universe by 2049, which is their centennial of the Chinese Communist Party taking power. All of their thinking is seen in a long view. We're very, very near focused. They highlight in their strategic documents the connectivity between the past, the present, and the future of Chinese strategic thought and the identity as a unified land within the restoration of a perpetual Sinocentric world order. Now, what does this all have to do with space? This is all very nice. Well, while the current international space legal regime, such as the Outer Space Treaty, have been ratified by the Chinese Communist Party, the Chinese may be heading toward a different view of where sovereignty ends. In fact, we've been seeing this more and more over the last few years. To the Chinese Communist Party, there is no legal demarcation that would prevent the Chinese from extending sovereignty into space. And while the Outer Space Treaty states in Article 2 that space is not subject to national appropriation by claim of sovereignty, by means or use of occupation or by any other means, from a legal perspective, there is troublesome indications that our increasing number of publications by influential Chinese authors are advancing the principle that China's sovereign territorial airspace extends through outer space. Now, for the last 50, 60 years, since 1957, when there's this international norm that everybody has just assumed it will continue forever, which is freedom of overflight. And that means that sovereignty ends where space begins, and everybody has a freedom of overflight over any country, and it's not a violation of sovereign airspace. However, if you look at the justification for their position on space, Chinese authors have asserted that territorial claims to outer space are not inconsistent with international law because there is no legally accepted definition of outer space that defines that demarcation point at which territorial airspace ends and outer space begins. Typically, in the US, we look at either 50 miles for astronaut wings or 100 kilometers, which is the Van Kármán line, which is about 60 miles or so. And they state that due to this lack of formal agreed definition to a claim, because China doesn't buy into that, China will assert sovereignty over all of orbital space above its territory. And even as we see with their push into cislunar space, and especially their operations on the far side, We're seeing a lot of actions on Earth that indicates that their actions in space will be no different. So, given the recent Chinese actions to exert sovereignty over an expanding terrestrial land and ocean claims in the Pacific, such as the South China Sea and the East China Sea, through establishment of what they call economic exclusion zones and air defense identification zone extensions, there are some concerns that the buildup of Chinese counterspace and space weapon systems and the very different strategic worldview and culture of the Chinese government could lead to legal assertions by the Chinese government that these exclusive economic zones or continental shelf acts provide legal basis for any attacks on foreign spacecraft overflying Chinese territory. One Chinese major general and his co-authors make clear that the area above the ground, airspace, and outer space are inseparable and integrated. They are the strategic commanding heights of modern warfare, and that the airspace over territorial waters and territorial lands are protected, but there is no clear standard in international law as to the altitude to which territorial airspace extends. Now, we can get into the what's called lawfare quite a bit, but there's basically a lot of disconnections here with how we're trying to frame our government and how we're trying to handle the problem of the threat of the Chinese multi-layered attack architecture, as they call it, and their potential use for it in active deterrence. We like to view it as everyone's just going to follow suit. We're going to be nice. We're going to show how everything is all about terrestrial support, how we're not trying to take war into space because we don't want to go there. But that's not how the Chinese think. So unlike the DoD's current framework in the Space Force, which relies upon Western values-based international agreements, codes of conducts, concern for sustainability in space, and things of that sort, the Chinese view of space deterrence consists primarily of warfighting capabilities that, quote, threaten adversaries from using their own space and/or terrestrial capabilities against Chinese forces pursuing their strategic objectives. So when counterpart negotiators are seen as adversaries and their interests are perceived to be in conflict, such as impositions of Western values and norms that negatively impact the sovereignty, control, and territorial integrity interests of the Chinese, their mobile warfare style is used. And this style's primary objectives are to, quote, exhaust, destabilize, and weaken the adversary by various means, including concealment, deception, and espionage. Now, when you look at the People's Liberation Army's writings on space warfare and deterrence, you see that the key piece of that is what they call real capabilities. And what they mean by that are systems that are capable of space attack and counterattack, and those are considered integral parts of battle planning by the People's Liberation Army in any future conflict. That's a quote from a Chinese document. This includes periods of tension as well as other levels of conflict. So, in other words, it doesn't have to be a full-scale war or an invasion of Taiwan or any of that sort of thing for them to feel the need to use such space weapon systems in order to do what they call attack to deter. They don't wait until we are under attack physically, or they are under attack rather physically. If they believe that they are under threat, they reserve the right to attack, and that is considered self-defense. It is not considered an act of aggression in the Chinese mind. So, in the Chinese language, it's important to also note that the definition of deterrence is different than that of the Western world. While the United States views deterrence as the prevention of war through a cost-benefit calculation, attempts at controlling misperception in the minds of the adversary, and things of that sort, like we see in their competitive endurance viewpoint, the Chinese word for deterrence is a combination of coercive punishment strikes and standard deterrence thinking from the Western perspective. So this is reflected in PLA authors encouraging commanders to gain space dominance, as space warfare directly serves one geographical part of an entire area of war, and its success or failure has immediate impact on the course of the entire area of war. So they view space as an area of responsibility, as a theater of conflict in its own right, and they believe that only through powerful, comprehensive national power, that is, space deterrence with credible military force, are they able to prevent attack and to protect their interests in space. So, how does the PLA organize this concept of deterrence and warfighting? Well, according to the PLA writings, the integration of space with other military forces is important in order to form the most effective military force possible. And by having the strongest military force in space possible, says Chinese authors, can a nation deter other nations from attacking it. So this means not only do they use space for their terrestrial actions, but they want to dominate space itself. And in order to win the war, Space is considered the commanding heights and must be won first. So total space supremacy must be won if the Americans are going to be defeated. So what they say is having a credible counter space capability to threaten another nation's space assets is required in order to deter the opponent from using its counter space systems, which, as we've talked about on this program before, we don't have near as many as they're building up. In addition to having credible counter space capability for effective space deterrence, the Chinese advocate that they should reveal firm resolve to dare and prepare to use this capability in order to create certain psychological pressure on and fear in the adversary and force the adversary to dare not conduct space operations with initiative. Now, this is interesting because the Chinese are very much into seizing the initiative. We, in our normal military planning, wait to be attacked. That's why, if you look in planning, we have shaping, deterrence, and then seizing the initiative back from the initiative gained attack from the adversary. So, in order to seize that initiative, this includes, according to their thinking, limited space operational activities with warning and punishment as goals as a means of de-escalating the crisis. So they will plan on using space weapon systems as a means of getting the United States to back off. This view of force-dependent deterrence reads more like a traditional deterrent model in the other domains that competitive endurance, our viewpoint, seeks to avoid. They don't seem to worry too much about the generation of debris or what it means to the Western way of life. They see that as a very important target. So our strategic viewpoint currently being thought through in the Space Force that purposefully avoids a credible threat of counteraction in the event of an attack on U.S. space assets, PLA writers, on the other hand, believe that the goal of deterrence is to display the horribleness, severity, and urgency of the consequences of the enemy attacking them. So if a period of tension arises, Chinese writers state that it is vital to achieving strategic objectives of the country, terrestrially and in space, to, quote, deliver destructive strikes to the enemy using maximum power in order to fight rapidly, conclude the operation rapidly, and to withdraw from the confrontation rapidly. And so space warfare is considered the first and most important area, according to their own writings. Now, how do they look at space domain? Well, we put a lot of stuff into low Earth orbit because we think that resiliency will protect us, when in reality, a lot of weapon systems are much cheaper on the Chinese side, whether it's the non-kinetic kind or the kinetic kind. And they view space operational area as a synthesis of many types of correlated military activity that includes space to space, space to ground, and ground to ground. And we've seen that with their demonstration of their hypersonic glide vehicle on their fractional orbital bombardment system that went around the Earth and back into a training range in China. So while a lot of people on our side would like to hope that the Chinese share the same interest in space or a view of enhancing the status quo of the U.S.-dominated international order, that is really not the case. And according to many scholars, the Chinese are on a quest for wealth and power. And as one other author stated, the Chinese are no longer guided by the old-school Maoist proletariat ideology and now see space technology, weapons in particular, as a major factor in its rise as a world power as it seeks increased influence and independence. And China's pursuit of space power, military space power, is a reflection of this emphasis on technology and grand strategy needed to regain the nation's former status as a great power that controls its own fate. Now, I wanted to transfer here now to what exactly are we supposed to do about this? Well, instead of doing this competitive endurance, which if you read through the document, nowhere does it indicate that we want to win the competition. It seems like we want to just either ignore it or continue this competition into the future without any sense of winning. I believe the U.S. should utilize uncertainty like the Chinese do. So we need to understand that Chinese military strategists are going to and have and will continue to attack key information and command and control nodes because all the analysis point to the fact that space will become and has become the deciding factor in future wars. Space will be the dominant battlefield, and that in order to achieve victory on Earth and preserve sovereignty control of Chinese territory, China must achieve space supremacy. And they include that because space is the dominant battlefield, in order to control Earth and their interests on Earth, that PLA analysts have concluded that war in space is inevitable. So even though space has been integrating space capabilities into their terrestrial forces, which is a true statement, as they state in this competitive document from the Space Force, that is not the main thing they're doing. They're building up weapon systems in order to fight and deter and win a war that is won in space and will slow us down tremendously if we're all we're focusing on is keeping things at the status quo level. Chinese leaders and strategists have increasingly regarded the dominance of space as one of their core interests, and I think this really shows that we really need more understanding of the adversaries, Chinese in this case, understanding that they have a unique decision calculus, they have a unique viewpoint of deterrence and war fighting in space, and they have no real concern, despite what they've been saying in diplomatic centers, about sustainability. If fighting a war in space, which they believe all space war of the future will be rapid and destructive, then how in the world are we going to expect them to be concerned about sustainability and stability in space when militarily that is not where they're going? It seems like our military response is not military. Talk about the threat, we talk about protecting, but we never talk about how we're going to defend. We don't talk about how we're going to deter. And if we do talk about deterrence, we're combining it with terrestrial deterrence as if somehow we're going to respond in some other domain, like bombing a target because a space battle is ongoing in orbit. And by the way, a one-sided space battle because one side is armed and the other side is not effectively armed is not really a battle. So keep that in mind. So with that, I appreciate you listening. This is Chris Stone for Real Space Strategy. Have a great day. Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Real Space Strategy. The Real Space Strategy Edition is produced under NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent on donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I want to thank our producer, Kimberly Sherrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.